Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. In his book, The Greatest Generation, Tom Brokaw wrote that the warriors of 60 years ago displayed towering achievement and modest demeanor. Their sacrifices enabled those who followed to prosper economically, politically, and culturally. They were, Brokaw concluded, the greatest generation any society has ever produced. This week we begin a four-part series investigating Brokaw's claims. Talking History's Fred Nielsen asked various historians whether the Second World War generation is really the greatest in American history, or whether the idea itself of identifying and crediting or damning a generation for a particular historical phenomenon is valid. But before we get to that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. Life magazine hit the newsstand 65 years ago this week and quickly became one of the most popular magazines of all time. Founded by Henry R. Luce, one of the most powerful figures in the history of American journalism, Life premiered on November 23, 1936, and changed photojournalism forever. The magazine brought to life wars, civil strife, people, culture, society, and nature with vivid photographs superbly chosen for their visual power. The pictures, taken by some of the greatest photographers of the day, spoke for themselves in a way that was authentic and moving, minimizing the need for lengthy description. Among the most memorable moments immortalized by Life were the sailor kissing the nurse in Times Square at the end of World War II, and the young Vietnamese girl screaming while running down a road napalmed by American bombers. The magazine ceased publication in 1972, but it returned as a monthly in 1978. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, a new theory has surfaced about what caused the Black Death that ravaged Europe between 1347 and 1352, killing an estimated 30% of the European population, and that plagued other parts of the world for the next three centuries. Scientists have traditionally linked the Black Death to a bacterium of bubonic plague that spread to humans by fleas from rats. Dr. Susan Scott and Christopher Duncan from the University of Liverpool, however, argue that an Ebola-like virus probably caused the Black Death. Their theory is based on medieval reports that the disease was passed from person to person, and the fact that Europe did not have the rodent species necessary to harbor bubonic plague during the years between outbreaks. The Rose Theater, the site where many of Shakespeare's plays were first performed, and the only Elizabethan theater left in the world with substantial remains, has become the focus of a campaign to fully excavate the site. Since its discovery in 1989, the Rose's timber planks and posts have been found to be so well preserved that the English Heritage and other trusts have put up money for its full excavation. Those planning to excavate the Rose have no doubt that the results of their effort will shed important light on the history of Elizabethan theater, a pivotal chapter in world cultural development. This is Talking History. Certainly one of the most serious competitors for Tom Brokaw's World War II generation as the greatest in American history is the nation's first generation, that of the Founding Fathers. To start our series on America's great generations, Talking History's Fred Nielsen investigates that group's claim to the title with historian Joyce Appleby.
Joyce Appleby is one of the nation's most distinguished scholars. She has served as president of both the American Historical Association and the Organization of American Historians. A professor of history at UCLA, she is the author of numerous books and articles on the 18th and early 19th centuries. Her book, Inheriting the Revolution, The First Generation of Americans, was published last year. Professor Appleby, welcome.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
In your book, Inheriting the Revolution, you suggest that the very idea of revolutions resonated with new meaning after the American Revolution.
Yes, it did, I think, because, well, all generations probably have a sense of themselves differentiated from their parents because there's so much conversation back and forth across the generations that confirm to people the fact that they're in a different age cohort. There are particular generations that have a greater sense of their identity, and the one after the revolution was certainly one of those. I think for the obvious reason that they had never participated in a colonial world, which was, you know, still filled their parents' imagination. They hadn't participated in the revolution, yet it was the major topic of conversation, explanation for why things were done this way instead of that way, and also a focal point of celebration and memorializing.
After the revolution, the United States, or America, I should say, changed from a fairly traditional society in many ways to a much more dynamic one with new opportunities of all kinds. What were some of the ways in which Americans sought personal independence during this period?
Well, I think the sense of a generation was particularly, to go back to your first question, particularly felt by people who were 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, in other words, adolescents who were really rushing towards adult status, and they were the ones that picked up on new opportunities while their parents tended to lag behind. And the new opportunities came both from the political fact of independence and then the derivative consequence that Americans could now develop their own economy outside the restrictions that Great Britain had placed on its colonies. So there was, shipping was an extremely important area of expansion because now Americans could go anywhere they wanted instead of staying into the channels that the British Empire had dictated, and you had the first ships going to India. In fact, America's first millionaire was made after the revolution from the China. So then Americans became the neutral carriers for belligerent Europeans who fought a succession of wars between American independence and finally the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo in 1815. So that was an area of expansion. But there were others that were fascinating. School teaching. There was a real sense that Americans now were self-governing and they needed to be educated. They at least needed to read and write. So districts, local districts, were formed to maintain schools. Now, these are pretty primitive schools, and they ran probably at most 9-10 weeks out of the year. But there were academies, and there were districts that had longer schools, and so this school teaching became a springboard for other careers. If a youngster, particularly a boy, but also girls, excelled in reading and writing, they could become school teachers with very little training, and then they got out of their little tiny rural area and saw a larger world and could go into, you know, studying with a lawyer and becoming a lawyer or being a clerk in the cities that were beginning to expand. It was also a time of a religious revival, what we call the Second Great Awakening. And this was this revival of religion was spurred by lots of new religions, the Baptists, the Methodists, the Disciples of Christ. There was one religious denomination after another was founded, and young men who felt a calling to become preachers just put their Bible in their saddlebags and rode off, and they didn't require the seminarian background that the mainstream churches, the Episcopalians and the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists, insisted upon.
There seems to be a close link here between political freedom, at least as inspired by the revolution, and freedom of economic opportunity. There's enterprise all over the place.
That's right. I think it's extremely important to see that they were not in opposition to each other, but they had there was just a freshet of energy coming from the fact that they were now independent and could do things. And even though personal independence in a family has nothing really to do with political independence of a self-governing people, that analogy was made. And I found in reading the autobiographies and memoirs of, again, particularly young men, but not exclusively, that there was a feeling that they could go out on their own at a very early age. Lots of New England boys became peddlers, and they would get buttons and needles and cups and books, and they would go south or through the middle states and sell these as peddlers. So they were learning, they were getting out on their own, leaving the family farm, learning about a larger world, but then acting as basic elements in an internal market, which is extremely important. Many of them brought back metal scrap to manufacturing, which is beginning to start up, to make brass objects, So it's just sort of fascinating to see how these human beings become dynamic elements in a range of exchanges.
And they don't just live this experience. They want to put pen to paper and write about it. Your book is based on several hundred autobiographies that these enterprising Americans wrote down. Is this an unusual time for autobiographical writing? Why are they writing so much about
this? Yes, it is unusual. I mean, Franklin, I think, is the first person that's credited really with an autobiography as distinguished from a memoir. And I think Franklin's autobiography was a model for lots of people. But you write an autobiography, I discovered from examining the people who wrote them and those who didn't, you write the autobiography usually at the prompting of family and friends who say, you know, someone ought to put that down. You've seen such amazing changes in your life. You should write about your life. I also found that autobiographers, they had the sense of having seen a lot and, you know, that they were a vanishing world needed to be recorded. But they also had to be mildly successful. People who sense themselves to be failures don't put pen to paper. So what you got from the autobiographies was just a subset of this generation of people who had moved into these new activities for the most part. The preponderance of autobiographies, though, were from ministers, but they were from ministers who were Baptist or Methodist, who were free now from the restraints of the established churches in the colonial era. I think they wrote because of their great sense of being a witness to the remarkable religious revitalization.
Your book, Inheriting the Revolution, makes the point that this first generation of the early republic inherited something from the past. I wonder if there's also a sense, though, in which they not only inherited but continued or perhaps even recreated the revolution.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. There is this. They did inherit it. I mean, there's no getting away from it. It was a legacy that was imposed on them. It was everywhere in the imagination and in tangible records, battle scenes, wounded veterans, a new governmental institution. But they were the ones who combined that, took that legacy, and followed these new opportunities. They had no psychological traces of ever having been a subject of a British king. And I think that this is extremely important. So they couldn't but change it. They didn't have the conservative traditions inside them. And they also had, for the most part, since I talk about people coming of age, they had this youthful energy, this desire to do something with independence. And so they created a tradition, not just about inheriting inheriting the revolution, but what America stood for, what America was supposed to stand for. And America didn't have any of the things that other countries had, other admired countries. Didn't have great buildings, didn't have a literary tradition, it didn't have imposing church structures. So they took what America did have, which was this freshness, this vacant land, as they considered it, even though it was well inhabited by Native Americans. They saw it as an undeveloped land. They saw these new opportunities. They saw self-government itself as important. And they associated those experiences with what it was to be an American and what the American nation stood for in the world.
Would it be fair, perhaps, to say then that they give life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness their own particular meanings?
Definitely. They give life, the sense of living their life, making their own choices. I found lots of struggles recorded in autobiographies between fathers and sons. Now, these, after all, are the sons' accounts, and I didn't have rarely did I have a father's account, though sometimes I did have their attitude towards their own children, which tended to be a good deal more conservative than they had been. And so there was a struggle for independence. Most young men growing up in rural America acknowledged that they owed their labor to their fathers until they were 20 or 21. And they would often make arrangements where they would send back money to their family in lieu of their being there to work. Or they made arrangements with other siblings to not make any demands on inheritance if they got a gift now from their family and went away. I would say in these rural families that probably half the kids moved out and the other half stayed put. So it isn't that everybody's moving, but it's that those who are are changing the landscape materially and politically and intellectually.
The founding generation bequeaths independence and its beliefs in life and liberty to a following generation. But I wonder, what would the founders have thought of the world that actually got created?
Well, lots of the founders live long. Jefferson and Adams die in 1826 on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Monroe lives another 15 years, Madison. So they lived, most of them, Washington did not, Franklin did not, Hamilton did not. But there's an array of revolutionary leaders, the ones I mentioned and others less well known, who lived well into the 19th century. For the most part, they're like most old people. They're dismayed. They do not see this as good. For one thing, the revolutionary generation divided politically in the 1790s when Jefferson went into opposition against Washington and Adams. And those political divisions lasted for another 30 years, and they were at first accompanied by great anger, sense of betrayal, outrage. So that hurt to see this old band of revolutionary leaders, comrades in arms, fellow lawmakers split politically. Because, of course, when these people are growing up, and I'm talking about young people, it's the revolutionary generation that's still in the positions of authority. It takes them until the 1820s or 30s to assume them. I think also the dynamism, while someone like Jefferson really wanted it and approved it, I think it seemed quite vulgar in many ways. You really did have a people that were, from the colonial standards, very ordinary, asserting themselves, taking leadership roles, writing, perhaps not writing in the same graceful 18th century manner that their parents or grandparents had. I think there was a tremendous amount of pride in America's material prosperity, the continued self-government, but I think there was kind of dismay at many of the social characteristics.
This first generation of Americans, the inheritors of the Revolution, as you spell out so clearly, did a great deal to create a democratic society, politically, in terms of business opportunities and so on. And yet, as you also make clear, they only went so far. Slavery is the most obvious example of how freedom was not universal. How should we understand their failure? What accounts for it? Should we focus more on what they achieved or on the things that they failed?
Oh, I think the failure needs to be studied very, very thoroughly, but I think it needs to be understood rather than condemned. There really was not any large anti-slavery movement until the middle of the 18th century. So this is one thing that you have to realize. It was a new reform. This is a venerable institution. It's recognized in the Bible. The New World slavery had been flourishing since the 16th century. So the idea of of saying this is a heinous human institution, we must get rid of it, was new. Slavery existed alongside of many repressive institutions, repression of children, of poor people, so it wasn't so stark as it seems to us now. In addition to which, there was deep racial prejudices, great sense of differences between European and African Americans. I think European Americans, white Americans, were very much afraid of falling back into what they saw as a barbaric stage. They looked at African societies as barbaric. They looked at Native Americans as barbaric. And they saw themselves as a little white outpost. So there was a tremendous pressure to extol what was distinctive about white culture, its technology, its science, its literature, its laws, and to see this differentiation. And then there was just the hostility that people feel about people who are different. I think you would be astounded at the things that the English said about the Irish. When the Irish began to come to America, they treated them almost as though they were from another continent and were another race. So I'm just trying to put into context this hostility to blacks, which certainly was there. At the same time, I think we have to celebrate what Americans did do, and the northern states did abolish slavery, starting with Pennsylvania in 1780. That was the first legislature in the world that had ever abolished slavery. They had a legislation that was complex. It provided for gradual emancipation. It was peaceful, but it was an invasion of private property. In New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, follow suit. Massachusetts, slaves take their masters to court for trespass, and the judges interpret the Massachusetts Constitution to not acknowledge slavery, so it's just wiped out with those court decisions. There weren't a lot of slaves in Massachusetts, probably not more than 6%. But in Manhattan, one quarter of the workforce was enslaved, composed of enslaved men and women. New York had a terrible battle abolishing slavery, but they did do it. So I think alongside of it, you have to see that the Revolution did promote anti-slavery feelings and laid the framework for the later abolition movement and Emancipation Proclamation. It's a very mixed record, but those, it takes a long time, as we in America know, in the 21st century to get rid of those prejudices.
Well, Professor Appleby, unfortunately we're out of time, but thanks for visiting with us today.
It's been a pleasure, Fred.
My guest has been Joyce Appleby, author of Inheriting the Revolution, The First Generation of Americans.
For the first program in our series investigating the idea of a greatest generation, we thought it appropriate to hear from one historian as to how strong a case Tom Brokaw has made for the World War II generation. Here to offer his perspective on that claim is Char Miller. Miller, chair of the Department of History at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He has written extensively on the history of public policy. His most recent book is Gifford Pinchot and the Making of Modern Environmentalism.
World War II ended 56 years ago, but the firefight over its significance in American culture has only just begun. Triggered by the 1998 publication of Tom Brokaw's best-selling volume, The Greatest Generation, it exploded into full public consciousness this spring with the announcement of the construction of a sprawling 7.4-acre World War II memorial on the Mall in Washington, D.C. Yet rather than commemorate the valor of the millions of men and women who brought the bloody war to its victorious conclusion, Brokaw's book, its sequels, and especially the proposed monument are but knee-jerk mementos of extraordinary hubris. Do Brokaw and his legion of readers truly believe that the mid-20th century cohort has had a more profound impact on the United States than the nation's founders, those who declared our independence, fought our revolution, and wrote our Constitution? Can they unashamedly assert that they were of greater consequence than those who battled to preserve the Union and smash slavery on the killing fields of the Civil War? Apparently they do. How else explain their eagerness to desecrate the National Mall, which by its vast green space and uplifting memorials to Presidents Washington and Lincoln vividly evoke the hard-fought triumphs of those who created and then sustained the Grand Old Republic? Yes, World War II was an essential blow against global tyranny. Yes, those who fought in it should be proud of their accomplishments and deserve a nation's profound gratitude. The GI Bill and a packet of other benefits were much deserved thank you notes. Yet what can one say about the so-called greatest generation's self-satisfied claims to historic preeminence, or its intensifying clamor to be lauded in print, consecrated in film, and enshrined in a massive mausoleum? Even Brokaw now admits he finds the racket unnerving, the special pleading demeaning. These former warriors' hunger for acclaim is also wonderfully ironic, for it was they who once mocked their baby boom children by dubbing them the me generation, an adult rebuke of alleged infantile self-absorption. The kids, it turns out, merely took their cues from their parents.
You've been listening to Char Miller, professor of history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. This is Talking History. For our site of the week, we've chosen a place associated with a member of the first generation of Americans, George Washington. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
For more than 45 years, George Washington called Mount Vernon home. When Washington inherited the estate from his brother's widow, the house consisted of four rooms on the first floor and three bedrooms on the second level. Even before he married Martha in 1759, he had already begun the process of enlarging the house to 2.5 stories and extensively redecorated the interior. Washington himself designed the stunning two-story piazza that overlooks the Potomac River. Today, the home has been restored to its appearance in 1799, the last year of Washington's life. From November 23rd through December 16th, you can enjoy an enchanted evening tour of the mansion, including a visit to the rarely seen third floor. And for something a little different on Christmas and New Year's Day, you can enjoy the holiday of Mount Vernon.
Finally, turning to our list of coming attractions, we have three interesting History Channel programs we'd like to call to your attention. On November 27th, the History Channel will present Defining a Nation, an exploration of the cultural symbols of the American dream, those icons that have defined the nation and lured immigrants from around the world to our shores. The program begins with America's first icon, George Washington, and includes many others like the Statue of Liberty, Uncle Sam, the Cowboy, Main Street, and Rosie the Riveter. On November 29th, America Transformed takes a look at how the United States changed in the post-World War II period from the 1950s through the 1970s. It explores the era when Americans dreamed of building a better future but ran smack into the turbulent changes of the times. Ozzie and Harriet, the Playboy Bunny, G.I. Joe, Muhammad Ali, the smiley face, and the disco ball are among the symbols of the age discussed in America Transformed. We'd also like to call your attention to a weekly History Channel program you might enjoy. Every Sunday morning, Hardcover History features in-depth interviews with authors of current historical books. Viewers have the opportunity to email questions and comments about the books and authors directly to the History Channel's website. As always, be sure to check your local listings for the exact show times of these History Channel programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oah.org. Until next time, when we will continue our series on The Greatest Generation, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.